From the heartland of America, the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, of course, those Friday night into Saturday morning open lines for you, followed by a year-end tribute to the late Dolores Cannon, hypnotherapist. What a woman she was. Here's what's happening. Police searching for a man suspected of shooting four young people near a high school in Portland, Oregon. The 16-year-old girl in the hospital in critical condition, 17-year-old boy in serious condition, and a 20-year-old man in serious condition as well. 19-year-old woman suffered grazing in a wound there as well. The shooting happened not far from the Rosemary Anderson High School campus in Portland. The Bay Area and other pockets of California began returning to normal Friday, but that storm that has lashed much of the West Coast, not done yet. More heavy rain, wind, snow forecast for the rest of this weekend, with a good chunk of inland California under flood warnings as a result. 1,200-year drought, but they needed some rain out there, that is sure. The Dow Jones falling more than 300 points, finishing the week with a 3.8% loss. This is the worst weekly performance in more than 3 years. Meanwhile, Americans, the U.S. consumer, you, confidence rising in December to a near 8-year high, a sign that falling gasoline prices and expectations of a better job market could give a boost to the economy. Let's check in, of course, with Howard Bloom to get his perspective on this. Well, it looks like the mood's changing a little bit, Howard, a little positive here.
It is changing, as long as that stock market hit doesn't hit us, because this is just in time for Christmas. And the University of Michigan's Consumer Confidence Index today hit 93.8, which is the highest reading since January of 2007, which means that consumer confidence has hit its highest point in 7 years. It's the highest point since the Great Recession punched us in the gut at the end of the George W. Bush administration. So today's jump in consumer confidence has staggered the economists. Economists expected confidence to tick up less than a meager single notch from November's 88.8 to a modest 89.5. After all, November's figure had been, get this, the highest peak that the Consumer Confidence Index had hit in 7 years. But instead, the consumer confidence figure surprised them. It went up at 6 times the rate the economists had expected. 6 times. Why? In part, it's because the economy had been slowly getting better for nearly 5 years. But once we've been knocked off our feet, we have a hard time believing that we're back on our feet again. It takes time before we regain our confidence. It takes time before we regain our belief that an uptick is really an uptick. But there's something more at work, and you put your finger on it. It's big. We talked about it Monday. Oil prices plunged today to $58.71 a barrel. That's less than half what oil prices were 6 years ago in 2008. In 2008, oil was $127 a barrel. So oil prices are down to half what they were, less than half.
But they will go back, Howard. There's no doubt about that.
I don't think they will. And, George, it's because of what we talked about on Monday. It's because the Chinese, who were gobbling up the world's oil, sucking it away from everybody else, driving the prices up, the Chinese are now producing their own oil. They are now a net oil exporter, which is phenomenal. So it means that the glut, that extra 2 million barrels a day of oil in the market that's going begging for buyers, is going to be out there and possibly even growing for a long time to come. But that, you know, there's a lot more to this. The oil prices are not just it. The economy's been growing for nearly 5 years straight. All the other developed nations have been stagnating. Europe, Japan, they've had hardly any economic growth at all, but the American economy has been growing at 2.5 to 3.5% per year. In fact, during the six-month period from April to September, our nation showed the strongest 6 months of economic performance in more than 10 years. Our economy rocketed an astonishing 4.6% from April of this year to June, and then it put in another power quarter from July to September, soaring by 3.95%. That is staggering in an economic climate where politicians moan about a failed economy. And that nonstop economic growth has had the impact you just alluded to. It's led to 57 straight months of job growth. That's 4 years and 9 months of new jobs. And during that time, we've added 10.9 million jobs in the private sector, not government jobs, private sector jobs. So we hear a lot of complaints that these are low-quality part-time jobs, and some of that is true, but the part-time claim is not. 95% of those new jobs are full-time. What's more, for the last few years, businesses have been accumulating big bankrolls of cash, big wads of profits. And it's hard to believe, but under the Barack Obama administration, hard as this is to imagine, businesses have been making record profits, but they've been sitting on their money.
Right. They're holding it, Howard. They're holding it. Look, if we can put a lid on the housing market so that doesn't crash again, we might be able to whittle our way out of this. Howard, thanks. You have yourself a good weekend. Howard Bloom. Native American tribes are allowed to grow and sell marijuana on their lands as long as they follow the same laws laid out for states that have legalized the drug. The announcement could give rise to rich new business opportunities on reservations. Unlike casino gambling, though, some advocates say only a handful of tribes have any interest in the marijuana business. Salt. Cutting down on salt could cut your headaches by a third, according to new research. People who reduced their salt intake to 3 grams a day suffered significantly fewer headaches, according to a study. 3 grams of salt is the equivalent of around a half a teaspoon. Now, don't forget, though, a lot of the foods that you eat already have salt in it. The amount found in a McDonald's Big Mac, for example, and fries is 3 grams of salt. So be careful. Experts say cutting salt could reduce headaches because it lowers blood and pulse pressure. Pope Francis will not meet with the exiled Tibetan leader, the Dalai Lama, because of the delicate situation with China. The Dalai Lama, who is visiting Rome, had requested a meeting. Not going to happen. Pope Francis continues to show he's anything but traditional. During a recent public appearance, the Pope comforted a boy whose dog had died, noting that one day we will see our animals again in the eternity of Christ. Paradise is open to all of God's creatures. What's else up there in God's creatures? UFOs, maybe? Let's check in with Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. What's our weekly update, Peter?
Well, good evening, George, and as always, thank you for sharing a little airtime with the National UFO Reporting Center.
Yes, sir.
First order of business is a big event that occurred down in California tonight. I started getting reports about 7:30 tonight, and I had forgotten that there was a launch out of Vandenberg of an Atlas V. So we took probably 20 reports from the Los Angeles area that people were seeing, I suspect, the Atlas V that was launched at 7:13 tonight. However, there was a very interesting event almost befitting the Christmas season, George. We start off with a report from none other than North Pole, Alaska. Last Saturday, the 6th of December, about 1 o'clock in the morning, two young women were driving home from a late run to a movie. About 1 o'clock in the morning, Saturday morning, and as they're driving down the road headed for home, they look up. There's a sort of a mystifying cluster of lights up there. They can't figure out what it is. After a second or two, they started putting the pieces together. It appeared to be a triangular craft, distinct triangular, with four solid white lights on the ventral surface and a flashing blue light. That flashing blue light is what interests me most, because that makes it virtually impossible for that object to have been any kind of terrestrial aircraft. It would be illegal, by my recollection, from my study of the federal aviation regulations, would be illegal for an aircraft flying at night to have a blue flashing light on it. The next day, Sunday, Pearl Harbor Day, the 7th of December, about 5:20 p.m., a young woman was driving home in North Vermont. She was driving from Stowe to Morrisville, Vermont, where her home is, a graduate student. She writes very well. In the clear night sky, a very peculiar object, she said, suddenly just appeared in the sky, perhaps bathed in orange light, descending very rapidly, but too slowly for it to have been a meteor. It drops below a nearby line of trees, and there's a bend in the road. She gets to a point where she should have been able to see it behind those trees, and absolutely nothing. People can read her very nice report for the 7th of December in Morrisville, Vermont. And the last report I have is from Morgantown, West Virginia. Tuesday of this past week, the 9th of December, a gentleman got up in the middle of the night, 2:30 in the morning, to have a smoke. Apparently he has to smoke often during the night. He's goes out on his patio, ground floor patio, and he's flabbergasted to see a black box sitting on the edge of his property. And then as he puts pieces together, he realizes that there's a skinny gray creature leaning against that black box, George. Suddenly the creature glides around to the opposite side of the box. The guy didn't see it for more than 10 or 15 seconds before he was going the other direction. People can read his report for Morgantown, West Virginia, the 9th of December. There's lots going on, and I'm truly grateful to all those Coast listeners who submit their UFO sighting reports, not only current reports, but past reports as well. We're getting a slew of reports, and they're really very, very interesting.
Peter, talk to you next week. Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center website, UFOCenter.com. One of my favorite movies ever, It's a Wonderful Life. It was one of those great Christmas-type feeling movies. Well, in a moment, Rich Martini back with me on Coast to Coast. It's a Wonderful Afterlife. Stand by. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, and for the next couple hours, we're going to take a leap into the afterlife. Rich Martini has written and directed a number of independent films, and after a dream vision of visiting his friend in the great beyond, Rich went on a literary quest to find out about the prevailing science and philosophical opinions on the afterlife, what they might be. He journeyed into Tibetan philosophy as well, made a number of documentaries in Tibet in India. Eventually was introduced to the work of the Newton Institute, founded by renowned author and hypnotherapist Dr. Michael Newton. And here's Rich back on Coast to Coast. Richard, always a pleasure. How are you?
Always a pleasure to hear your voice, George.
Boy, so you've got a little experience in Tibet. What's your take on the Pope not wanting to meet with the Dalai Lama because he doesn't want to upset China? I think that's nuts. He should.
And you know what? It's unfortunately, I like the Pope. I mean, I really like
I do
the
too,
guy.
Yeah.
But it's his loss. You know, the Dalai Lama is a really wonderful person to be around. He's a compassionate guy. Every time I've met him, I've felt elevated after I left the room. And I've talked to other people. There's some kind of an unusual experience you have when you shake this guy's hand. It's like there's an energetic form going on that you've never experienced before. So all I can say is it's his loss. You know, ultimately, they're both men of peace, and they both have really wonderful things to say. And it's just a shame because I've been to Tibet, and I know how much the Tibetan people are suffering under the heel. You know, 120 people have killed themselves, torched themselves, rather than live another day in Tibet. And that's, you know, we just kind of turn our backs on that sort of thing. So, of course, I'm very passionate about it, but we could go down that path, and, you know, that would be a different evening, let's put it that way.
Yeah, I was just a little disappointed when I saw that story.
Terribly disappointed.
Yeah. I would have thought I would have thought the Chinese would have realized this is different. These are two worldly figures of spirituality. Come on, let them meet with each other.
Well, the whole history of the Tibetan region and the Chinese invasion, the unusual thing, and I was just having this discussion with somebody the other day, is people consider Buddhism to be a religion, and, you know, even the Dalai Lama calls it a non-theistic religion. And then when the Chinese marched into Tibet, they made sure a lot of these people went to the afterlife quickly because they didn't believe in that. You know, they had their own philosophy of atheism. But ultimately, Buddhism, as you know, is more of a philosophy because it's just a manner of living more than it is a religious thing. And I don't want to get on a soapbox about it, but just to follow your thought, it's a shame that the Dalai Lama doesn't get a chance to meet this new guy who really seems to be a compassionate, you know, human being.
So one of my favorite movies, I remember my mom sat me down when I was just a little kid and said, Georgie, you're going to watch this movie with me. A little black and white movie, and I said, okay, Mom, and I watched it, and I was fascinated by it at that young age, and I'm still fascinated today. It's
well,
a wonderful
life.
Well, you
know, it's interesting. It's interesting that that film actually came from a near-death experience that Frank Capra had.
Really?
He writes about it in his book, Name Above the Title. And back in, I think it's 1939, he made that film, It Happened One Night. It swept the Oscars. And after he won an Oscar, everybody said to him, Frank, what are you going to do next? And he started saying, you know, don't bother me. I'm not really sure. And then he started saying, you know, I don't really feel well enough to take that meeting. And then essentially and eventually that became like a psychosomatic illness. He wouldn't get out of bed. And doctors came to see him and ultimately said, he's dying. And in his book, he says he was probably a week from death because he wasn't eating. He had just given up hope. And his assistant, Max, said, there's someone here to see you. And he said, I don't want to get out of bed. And he said, well, the guy insists. And so this guy comes up to a second floor. Frank crawls out of bed and goes into this room. And there was this, what he called like a faceless guy, like a bald man with glasses who had never seen before. And he said, what can I do for you? And the guy said, you're a coward. You're a coward, Frank Capra. You're laying in bed there when you should be out doing the thing that you're supposed to do on the planet, which is make people laugh. And at that point, Max had turned on the radio, and Hitler could be heard, you know, pontificating in the next room over the radio. And this faceless man said, listen to that guy. He's spreading evil, and you can spread joy and laughter, and you can do it in the dark for millions of people. And then he said, you're a coward, and he left. And Capra said he never figured out who the guy was. He didn't, you know, Max didn't know who he was.
Huh.
And he didn't want to know who he was, but he called up his writing partner, and they went out and sat down in a hotel out in Palm Springs and wrote It's a Wonderful Life.
It must have been Clarence the Angel who visited him, too.
Well, it was interesting enough, Robert McFarlane had an experience with, you know, the film. I don't know if you remember him. He was the Secretary of, I think, Defense during the Reagan era, and he got really depressed and tried to commit suicide. And somebody sent him a copy of It's a Wonderful Life. And when he sat down and watched it, he realized, you know, there was more to his life and more to, you know, to what he could offer the planet. And so, you know, after my success of Flipside, and thanks to you, George, I got to say, you know,
You did all the work, Richard.
The two times I've been on your show, it's gone to number one at Amazon. So, you know, and people calling me from all over the world about you and about, you know, Flipside. And ultimately, I just kept, it got me addicted to filming more sessions of these between life sessions. But I also wanted to expand the scope of the research into near-death experiences. And I was interviewing a friend of the show, Gary Schwartz.
Yes.
And Gary and I were talking to my literary agent, this guy, Joel Kotler. And Gary said to him, Joel, so tell me, if it's true that there is an afterlife, if we could prove it to you, how would you feel? And he said instantly, I would feel just like Jimmy Stewart in It's a Wonderful Life. Everything would be changed. I would see the whole world through this passionate, happy vision. And I looked at both of them. I said, well, that's the name of the new book. Obviously, It's a Wonderful Afterlife. So that's the genesis of the title of this book. But like I say, I had at some point I was doing a book talk in Virginia Beach, and I got to meet Bruce Grayson, who's the father of near-death studies. He's at University of Virginia. And we sat down, and he had read my book, and he had everyone in his office read the book. And so we had this conference where I got to meet all these, you know, great scientists from Ed Kelly from, I think he went to Yale, and Jim Tucker, who's a guy who does reincarnation research, all scientists. And they said, you know, Rich, we really appreciate your research, but it's based on hypnosis, and we don't consider hypnosis science. And I said, well, that's true, because the way that hypnosis has been done for 100 years after Freud started using it was, you know, people would go in to see a doctor, and then the doctor would want to cure them. And while they're on hypnosis, they would remember things. And of course, the time slot was like an hour. I said, in Michael Newton's case, here he is. He's using 6-hour time slots. He's asking neutral questions. And then if you just follow the logic, thousands of people across the planet are saying the same things about the afterlife. So there has to be some fire where that smoke is. But I realized near-death experiences have been studied scientifically, and Bruce has done a lot of that work, thousands and thousands of cases.
And he's a believer that consciousness operates outside of the brain, isn't he?
Correct. And he's got a wonderful YouTube video, Is Consciousness Created by the Brain? And what he says in the video is, of course, some consciousness is created by the brain. Of course, we imagine things, we think of things. But he explores these scientific cases, these cases that are in medical literature of people who have severe Alzheimer's. This is just one of four instances he uses. severe Alzheimer's who have lost their ability to communicate. And then just prior to death, either a few minutes or maybe an hour or a day, they suddenly regain full consciousness. And
hold on for a second, Richard. We're going to come back. We'll come back and talk more about this on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast, a full couple hours with Rich Martini as we talk about his latest work, It's a Wonderful Afterlife. So, Rich, we were talking about consciousness, Dr. Grayson's work there, and Gary Schwartz, I think, believes in that same concept, that consciousness exists outside the brain. And if that's true, that really, to me, is proof that the afterlife is out there, doesn't it?
Well, you know, let me put it this way. And just to finish that thought, what sure. Grayson found was that it was almost like when people passed, just as they passed away, just prior to passing away, they suddenly remembered everything about their life and they were able to communicate. And even though autopsies were done on their brains, they shouldn't have been able to communicate, but they were. And it's as if the filters that are somehow put into place when we come onto the planet, they prevent us from remembering all this stuff, our previous lifetimes, et cetera, et cetera. And that somehow the death of the brain causes the death of these filters. That was just something he talks about in this video. And so that idea that definitely the consciousness, it's like an FM receiver, if you want to think of it that way. You know, you mm-hmm. fiddle with the dials. Some people are better tuned. Some people, you know, and you know what happens when you have a cell phone, you're trying to get better reception. What do? You go to higher ground. You know, and going to higher ground might be going to church. It might be, you know, talking to somebody who can help you connect with spirit. It might be meditation. But that idea of how do you connect with this consciousness that's out there that is part of who we are? And that is what I've tried to expand upon in this newest edition of this research. I examined near-death experiences, quite a few. I talked to people who had both near-death experiences and between-life sessions so they could examine what happened during the near-death experience. And I've shown how people who have near-death experiences, they have these hallmarks that science, you know, talks about, that they're almost identical to the same hallmarks that someone has during a life-between-life session. So I'm fond of saying having a life-between-life session is like having a near-death experience but without the near-death part.
You know, Rich, there's so much to learn, too, about life, the universe. I mean, we can't figure out how the Egyptians or someone built the pyramids. Right. We don't understand, and I'm talking about science really doesn't understand, the afterlife at all. They're still trying to figure out what the heck a black hole is in the universe. There's so much out there, but when you look at everything and put it all into perspective and just bring it down to that common denominator, which is life itself, you have to assume that there's much more than just all of this, and that includes the afterlife, you know.
Yeah, that's right.
Precognition, well, all that.
Well, I'm also thinking of it from this angle, which is in the 25 sessions that I filmed and transcribed, and I choose the subjects. They aren't people, so I've eliminated that problem with hypnosis, which is the people aren't coming because they have a problem. I choose them because they're skeptics. And I know who they are. I know their background. I know what they're saying under hypnosis about their own life. And then when they start talking about previous lifetimes, I'm as fascinated as anyone to hear what they have to say. But also, the hypnotherapist doesn't know that they have a problem or what their problems are until they get there and they start examining them. And what I'm fond of saying is, you know, listen, around the holiday season, you hear Frank Sinatra everywhere. How do you know it's Frank Sinatra? Well, you know the timbre of his voice. It's recognizable instantly. Now, if Frank Sinatra spoke to his children, let's say, or the relatives that are still on the planet that knew him, and said something to them, they would therefore have to think, well, he must still be alive. So now, if you just follow that logic for a second, you and I are talking on the phone right now, or talking on the radio, you assume that I'm alive, right?
But I sure hope so.
But how do we know that I'm alive? And the only way we know I'm alive is because I'm saying new things that you couldn't have thought up, correct? You know, aside from those computers that pretend to be human.
That's right.
But
how do you know I'm alive?
Exactly. But you're saying things that I don't know you're going to say. And so now if somebody from the afterlife says something to you new, then therefore they must be alive. So when Ibn Alexander has his near-death experience, or Colton Burpo has his near-death experience, and they meet up with sisters, both of them met up with sisters who they did not know they had, and the sisters communicated new information to them, then therefore those sisters must be alive. So my point is, this is the really wonderful thing about this research, is it's really proving, and by the way, the other day I met an FBI profiler, Jennifer Schaefer, really an amazing person who goes around as a medium and helps find missing persons. And
wow.
Immediately I wanted to interview her, and so I spent 5 hours, you know, doing an incredible interview with her the other day.
Yeah.
But she said frequently when she's doing her work, she'll ask somebody, are you alive? And of course, they always say, yes, I am alive, even though they don't mean they're on the planet. Because, of course, we're just stepping through a door. We're moving into another, you know, bees can only see, you know, bees see much more of the spectrum than we can, right? They can
That's
see
right.
ultraviolet rays. That doesn't, because we can't see them, doesn't mean it's not there. So this research explores these other rays, these other realms, these other things that we can't see, but that people under hypnosis sometimes experience, under a near-death experience, under a coma, sometimes an out-of-body experience. Now, how about this? I had an attorney call me and say, I've represented people who are accused of second-degree murder. And she said, in every case, the client said to me they had a dream, a vision, or a visitation from the person they killed.
Gosh.
And the person said, I'm okay. And I can help you. And, of course, you can't tell anybody this. You can't tell the family. You can't tell it in court. You can't tell the judge. But they told it to this attorney. And she was calling me. And she read lips.
Were they haunted by this?
Absolutely, because we don't have this language to talk about it. We have no science to talk about it. We have no doctors to talk about it. We don't really have a language to understand it yet, let's just say. And Gary Schwartz, by the way, makes this great analogy. 100 years ago, those guys who sat around and watched the Wright brothers fly, they couldn't possibly imagine in 100 years how many people would be flying every day.
No, not at all.
100 years from now, we're going to be talking about the afterlife in a completely different fashion. Because, and just to your point, which is all these things that are unknowable, you know, like what happened in the pyramids. Well, are they unknowable? If the people who built the pyramids are still alive, they may have reincarnated, we can ask them questions, can't we?
Yes.
If we find the right source, we find the right person, we get to the highest ground, let's call it that, you know, we get to the better reception. If we ask those right questions to the right people, you know, let's pretend that we're doing a hypnotherapy session and the guy says, you know, I was there. I was there when the pyramids were built. So now, let's say instead of letting him going home after the session, we say, look, we're going to spend like 3 months with you, and we're going to grill you, and we're going to do this thing over until we get these secrets. Because, of course, they aren't secrets. They're just part of human knowledge. And because we don't really have, you know, this ability to access it here, that doesn't mean it's not inaccessible. It doesn't mean it's inaccessible. It means it's somebody has to figure out how to access it. So wouldn't it be great to talk to Einstein? Wouldn't it be great to talk to Jesus, who makes an appearance in It's a Wonderful Afterlife? I mean, I don't interview him, but somebody does, and I don't know if it's him, and it's controversial. But let me just say, what this person who is claiming to be Jesus in this interview says is right in a line with everything we've been talking about the afterlife, about the journey of souls, about reincarnation, about these things. And my point is, there are things that are knowable. We just have to figure out a way to find out how to source them out.
When you were at the Newton Institute with Michael Newton, tell me a little bit about what they did there, because he is a noted hypnotherapist. What kind of things did they do?
Well, when I tracked him down, you know, I tracked him down as a skeptic. I had read that he had 7,000 cases, and they all said the same things about the afterlife. And I thought, well, how could that be? He must be leading them or something. So I contacted Paul Orend, who was the then president of the Institute, and I said, you know, I'd like to make this documentary about Michael. And he said, oh, he's retired, and he's not working like that now, but you can come to our conference. I thought, well, that's unusual. They're going to let me film their conference? Great. So I flew to Chicago. they let me open, you know, turn my cameras on and film. And Michael was there. And so once I met him and talked to him for a few minutes, he saw where I was coming from, you know, a student trying to learn. What is it? What are you doing? And he granted me his last interview. As he said it, you know, I'm sick of doing interviews. He's alive and well, but he just doesn't do interviews anymore. But when we did this conference, he stands off to the side with a whiteboard, and while the hypnotherapist is doing the session, you know, and again, it's 6 hours, so the first hour is just relaxing and going through your lifetime and walking back. And Michael has sort of, out of his 7,000 cases, figured out a way in the case of me filming, three or four hours, to not only go through a previous lifetime, but to go to the end of that previous lifetime and use that as a gateway. When they get to the end of the previous lifetime, they'll say, so where do you want to go? And you know what they always say? 25 people have said it to, on camera, film, you know, that I've been filming. They say the same thing. They say, I want to go home.
I want to go home.
And when I first heard it, my brain went, what do you mean, like Chicago, Boston? What are they saying? And then I realized they're talking about this other place, that this is not home, that this is the stage. You know, I mentioned Roger Ebert in the book. He, just previous to dying, he told his wife, Chaz, who I've met both of them, of course, and he said, he wrote a note to her that said, it's all an elaborate hoax. And she said, what do you mean? What's an elaborate hoax? And he was trying to say, you know, the world. Now, it's funny. Here's the world's greatest movie critic. He couldn't have used a different analogy. This is the most elaborate movie, because that's really more akin to what we're talking about here. People playing roles, people donning costumes, people working out energies, people working out what I'm fond of calling stones in your path, that when you go over the stone, go through the stone, go around the stone, it turns into gold, because you've learned that lesson of how to go beyond the thing that has prevented you from being who you truly are. So those kind, and so Roger Ebert, you know, when he called it an elaborate hoax, you know, hoax implies something negative. My wife, Sherry, she says, you know, think of it more like a school. This is like a very incredible school that we're in. Not everybody succeeds. Not everybody gets to the head of the class. Some people do, but we do honor everybody in the classroom. And the other really wonderful thing I've learned in this research is that in the afterlife, everyone is equal. No one gets to hoard the jelly beans. There's old souls, there's young souls, but they all treat each other with the same amount of respect. And of course, we don't do that on the planet, right? We spend a lot of time thinking about who hoards the jelly beans.
That's right.
But, you know, and so if our natural state of being, home, is where we don't treat anybody less than anybody else, that's a wonderful thing to aspire to while you're here on the planet. And takes us back to the Dalai Lama, I must say, because this is a guy who has spent that his whole life doing that, treating everybody as if they're equal. You know, he calls himself a simple monk for a reason, because he really believes that.
So, Richard, tell me about this controversy about this interview that was conducted with Jesus.
It's a little bit unusual. The way it came to me was a doctor who I know was conducting a session with a medium, and the medium was contacting her son. And the three of them were having this conversation. And at some point, she was having a difficulty with the volume of this particular session. And so she sent it to me as a filmmaker and said, you know, could you check out? I'm having a problem hearing the sound. So I boosted the sound. And when I listened to this interview, which was her son and this medium and Jesus, who came to the session, I at some point heard someone answer a question, a male voice. The question was, I forget what the question was, but the answer was yes. And you could hear a male voice said yes. And then the medium said, he said yes. So I boosted that and checked it out. And I called the doctor and said, have you listened to this tape? There's people talking on the tape. I said, was there workmen in the medium's house? Was, you know, someone standing off camera? She assured me there was not. So in this particular interview, Now, here's what the other weird part of it was, that in the interview, Quentin Crisp, the author, shows up. And he was a notorious flamboyant fellow, right? It was very persecuted in the 50s and 60s.
In his day, yeah.
Yeah. And he shows up and says, I'm here because I want to hear my friend Jesus talk. And what's funny about it is the doctor and the medium didn't know who he was. And he was only saying, my name is Quentin. And then they were, you know, asking, well, you know, are you an author? Who are you?
Who are you? Yeah.
Yeah. And I just thought, you know, look, if you're going to make something up, you're not, this is the last guy you're going to put in your audience, you know.
Yeah.
And he makes some funny jokes. It's very controversial because it's head spinning in the sense that Jesus, whoever this is, I won't call him Jesus, whoever this person is, speaking from the flip side, says that he was here primarily to teach people that the afterlife is very close, that we treat people equally in the afterlife, and we should treat them equally in this life. So the idea that the kingdom of God is near is not necessarily a religious concept, but a proximity concept. But his mission, of course, was to, you know, show love to everyone, show compassion to everyone. And as he put it, it seemed to have gotten convoluted, you know, along the way.
What's the biggest message, Rich, you'd like people to take with It's a Wonderful Afterlife?
We don't die. There's no reason to fear worrying about dying. I know that, you know, it's stressful when people...
People don't want to stress out. They don't want to check out too early.
No, that's true, but you're here for a reason. You're here for a reason. Now, this is really the takeaway. I said that because it's kind of a, you know, funny sentence, but the real takeaway is during one of the sessions I asked, what or who is God? I didn't ask. I'm sorry, the person doing the session did.
It's a great question.
It's a great question, and the spirit guide answered and said, first, God is beyond the capacity of the human brain to comprehend. It's not physically possible, which is a pretty logical sentence when you think about hard drives and information. At first, I thought he was ducking the question, but then he said, but you can experience God by opening your heart to everyone and to all things. And in that moment, I saw that idea that God is love is actually should be turned around. Love, the thing that connects all of us, is what God is.
I mean, I have learned in my years, Rich, that we're here to help other people.
And that, you're doing that, a lot of it, I must say.
We're here to make people a little more aware of things about life and how to, you know, treat other people.
Yeah.
And prepare yourself for that other side. And, you know, hopefully you don't come back. You know, I think I've always believed that reincarnation is the learning process. But once you get to that point where you've learned it all, you stay and enjoy yourself. You don't come back anymore.
Well, you know, here's the thing. What I'm hearing in these sessions is you go back there and it's fantastic back there. That's what everybody says. They all say it's you feel unconditional love, okay? And when you're back there, your friends come to you and say, George, you know, listen, I know you're having a good time here, but we really need you to come down here and help us learn this lesson. And you can say, no, you don't have to come back. No one's telling you have to. You can say no, but your friends, the ones you love, the people you love the most, come to you and say, I need you to play this role of this Viking character, and you got to go out and hurt people and whatever, do your thing, and we're all going to learn from it. And you can say, oh, I don't want to do that, but they say, you know, you were so good in the Roman era. We just love how good you are playing that role.
Rich, stay with us. We got more to talk with you about when we come back on Coast to Coast AM.